This is Thorne Dreyer, and this is RAG Radio. Thank you for being with us again today. I've been gone, as Alan Campbell, who just introduced us at the end of People United, pointed out that RAG Radio is all new. We haven't been for the last couple of weeks because, among other things, Dreyer has two new eyeballs. Tracy, what do you think?
They look well.
They look good. You like my new eyeballs?
They do all right.
I had eye surgery and got rid of my cataracts and had toric lens replacements. So I'm a new man, except I have to use reading glasses now. I had worn glasses since I was, 18 years old or something. And here, so I'm just at a loss. I wander around without glasses and I keep looking to see where I left them. Anyway, that's what's happening here. RAG Radio comes your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll rebroadcast on we originally are broadcast on KOOP Hornsby Austin in Hornsby. What am I saying, Tracy? Hornsby, Austin.
Hornsby, Austin. Yeah, Hornsby, a small town outside of Austin.
That's right. Or town in France.
That's where our tower is.
Small
anyway.
Town in France. And we're streamed live by the station. Co-op is a community radio station, all volunteer and cooperatively run. So, and we're rebroadcast on WFTE in Mount Cobb in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and on KPFT in Houston on their HD3 channel. So, yeah. And speaking of KPFT in Houston, Tracy Schultz, by the way, is my engineer and co-producer. That's who keeps yapping over there on the other side of the
Happy Tracy. To be here, as always.
Okay. Our special guest today is pioneering gay rights activist and Houston living legend, Ray Hill. Ray, who was a co-founder and longtime broadcaster at KPFT-FM, Houston's listener-sponsored Pacifica radio station, has been widely honored for his human rights advocacy and his work on behalf of prisoners' rights. Ray, who spent 5 years as an inmate in the Texas prison system, produced and hosted The Prison Show, a landmark radio program that aired on KPFT for 3 decades. This April, Houston Mayor Anise Parker roasted Ray Hill at a benefit for KPFT, and last Saturday, May 30th, Ray was named a Houston Living Legend by the Harris County Democratic Party as one of 7 public figures honored for their lifelong contributions, quote, to the advancement of progressive politics in Harris County in the state of Texas. 74-year-old Ray Hill came out as a gay man to his family and to his fellow students at Houston's Galena Park High School in 1958. It's been a wild ride ever since. Ray Hill. Is that all pretty accurate?
You know, the guy you describe, I'd like to meet him someday. Sounds like a nice feller. But
He's a pretty cool guy. I think I first met
him. I don't know if I can live up to all of that. You know, the part of my life that I was explaining this morning to a politician who was trying to get me to come do a fundraiser for their campaign, the part of my life that I least like is the celebrity thing. And you just live long enough and get in the news often enough and you get celebrity status, which as far as I can tell is absolutely useless to yourself, but it may help other people.
Yes, it gives you visibility for the issues that you want to
Right. And the opportunity to get invited to do
to
another
lots of parties
unpaid
and stuff.
Job.
get you interviewed on RAG Radio. Although
celebrity
status.
I've been following you on the internet. I appreciate what you're doing. This is kind of incestuous. It's kind of like the piece that This American Life did on the Prison Show. You got a radio guy talking to a radio guy about doing radio. You don't get more incestuous than that, Thorne.
Well, maybe you can get a little bit more, but yes, you're right. And speaking of which, we've known each other, since the late 60s.
Sure.
Somewhere around in there. And our paths have been somewhat parallel. You managed to last 2 years managing as general manager of KPFT, and I only made it a year.
So. Well, I came in with the intention that, I didn't want that sucker job, and I would do that for 2 years and no mas.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, nobody should want that job.
I don't understand how these long-termers can stand it, because it certainly is a thankless position.
Yeah, I was fine with the programming part of it. The raising the money is what,
well,
and that's
I
what
mean,
it's mostly.
You know, and you've got to realize that you've got, what, a couple of hundred volunteers coming in and accessing the radio waves, any one of which can get you into worlds of trouble at the drop of a phrase.
I think it was on it was on some website, some blog. Said in 1980, Ray became station manager of KPFT. He lasted 2 years in that position, longer than most. When one of the previous
I think at the time that was the record.
That was the record. When one of the previous station managers locked her office and left without so much as a word, Ray's latent talents were called into action. Quote, since I had experience as a burglar, he recalls, I was asked to pick the lock to her office door. I wasn't really looking forward to possibly finding a dead body behind the door, but I opened the office anyway, piece of cake. Luckily, no dead body.
that's kind of the way that happened. Judy had left 2 weeks earlier without saying a word to anybody. We found a note on her desk that since she locked her office, we wondered how she imagined anybody would read it.
Would read the note if it was inside the office?
And she said it was the first, and she used some expletive job she had ever had, and she gets damn sick and tired of it, and adios. And if she never comes back, that'll be too soon.
One thing before, I want to go back in time in just a second. And I want to, you know, but before we do that, as long as we're talking about KPFT, and we will, I definitely want to talk about the prison show and about your experience also in prison and how that fed your understanding. We both have some experience there. But I noticed the one thing about KPFT, Pacifica, KPFT is the Pacifica Foundation has how many? Five radio stations?
Five radio stations. And then there's some ancillary things like the archive, and I got some message from Brian DeShazer today. He had some archaeologists coming in there. Archaeologists coming in there with like khaki jackets and things, and they found the audio tape of the National March on Washington that I was national chair and MC on the stage in 1979, and they just found the tapes.
Well, it's amazing because there's some incredible history involved there. I remember when the Guru Maharaji came to Houston, to the Astrodome, KPFT did live bliss-to-bliss coverage of the whole event. And we had Paul Krasner and, I don't know, Jerry Rubin, I think, and I don't remember who all, Marjo Gortner, as commentators. And that's great history. I don't know if the tapes to that exist. One of the things that I discovered, I programmed, I had a show called The Briar Patch, which lasted for really quite a while, and none of it exists. Apparently, the air checks were recorded over, I was told.
Well, they did that. They certainly did not do that whenever I came. Whenever I came, I saw to it that the air checks were kept. The air checks were, of course, not of the kind of quality that you would archive.
Right.
It was there for background information and that sort of thing alone. But the stuff that you save for the archive, and they did not do that with the prison show for many years, except for the air checks. I kept the air checks, but that's not really broadcastable today because it's a tape that is moving so slowly you don't have any quality at all.
Right.
But then about a decade or so ago, they upgraded the tapes or the taping of the prison show so that now that's usable archive.
Right.
And Brian DeShazer has done a wonderful job over there. He's a big fan of KPFT. And by the way, I was in the station this morning and talked to the fearless leader. That's the term we use for the current sucker in place.
Whoever that might be at a given time.
It's been Dwayne Bradley now for almost 8 years. And
there must Dwayne be something wrong with that guy.
That we paid the down payment on the new transmitter, which was funded basically from my roast.
Wow.
And it is being assembled somewhere at the factory in Maine. And they'll roll it out to the loading dock in a few months. But they're not going to ship it until we give them the rest of the money.
I should point out that when Ray refers to his roast, this is not something he did, in the kitchen and then auctioned on eBay. This was when he was roasted by a number of prominent figures, including the mayor of Houston.
Well,
and this was
just
2 months ago.
The mayor, one of the things she said at the roast is that if it had not been for Ray Hill and his political organizing of the gay, lesbian, transgendered community, that she would not be mayor of this city. And she's one of my proteges. She's the most successful of my proteges.
A lot of people don't even realize that Houston has now an outgoing, three-term?
Yes.
Gay woman mayor. Which is also indicative, and we will talk about this too, of Houston's history and the history of Houston's gay community, because Houston has always, ironically, despite the fact that we fought off the Klan for quite a few years there, and that Houston was always like a big, oil-driven boomtown, Houston was, I think, in my experience, a fairly tolerant city for gays and lesbians at that point.
Well, you're welcome. I worked on that for 40 years.
Thanks to Ray Hill, especially.
Yeah, well, I didn't do it by myself, but no. I managed to get credit for it all because the people that I worked with earlier on, all the males died of HIV and AIDS, and the women survived, like Anise. But my fingerprints are all over their political careers. That's been quite a journey. And Zorin, as an activist, and let's explain something. My parents were labor goons.
Okay.
My mother tried to organize nurses for the Teamsters. That did not work. But she was very proud of that effort that failed. And my father had a little better luck organizing for the AFL. CIO shipyard workers, and they were very proud of that work. I was raised where we talked about Saul Alinsky. I thought Joe Hill was a relative. We were so labor goon oriented that's a whole subculture. So, as I say in a recent documentary, I am the one queer ex-convict who grew up to be exactly who his mother intended him to be.
Well, that's wonderful. That is pretty remarkable. Your journey has been an amazing one. As long as we're talking about journeys in history, you wrote in a Facebook post, which I recently read, was reposted somewhere. You wrote it, I think, about 2 years ago. You said the GLBT movements have come a long way since I began writing about the need for change in 1966.
Yeah.
One could go to prison in all states if caught in gay lesbian intimacy. If caught in the opposite gender's clothing, going to jail was a given.
Yeah.
The suicide rate was the highest then among any other among any other class of people, and violence against us was rarely investigated and even more rarely prosecuted. The police themselves were frequently responsible for violence against us. Our jobs and educations could be rendered insecure after every raid on our gathering places. Our birth families more frequently rejected us than not. So have we come a long way, baby?
Oh, indeed. and absolutely indeed. You now have mothers of gay men out trying to find husbands for their sons.
Which is certainly a change.
Oh, your son's a doctor. Is he married?
Well, everybody talks about how that history has changed. I mean, the trajectory of history has changed dramatically. I mean, now what's in the headlines? Caitlyn Jenner, gay marriage to be decided soon before the Supreme Court, which I think all indications suggest that it will be a 5-4 vote for.
The transgendered movement is the new kid on the block. It traced its political roots to 1978. In Houston, Texas, I had called a town meeting one in response to my discovery in 77 that when Anita Bryant came to town, the term gay community changed.
You should tell people just who don't know who Anita Bryant was and what she stood for.
Anita Bryant was she was Miss Runner-Up Miss America from Oklahoma. And it was what her initial fame was. I've written a play, Whatever Happened to Anita Bryant, and it hadn't got any traction yet, but it should. Anita and I are the same age. Well, she's a few months older than me. She was born in March, and I was born in October of 1940. But she had married a cured gay guy by the name of Bob Green, a radio guy, actually.
Cured is in quotes, by the way.
That'd be important? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, well, because the divorce was about his not being that cured.
Yeah.
And Anita, when she divorced him, did not know that divorce records were public records. And so Bob Kunst, an activist friend of mine in Miami, were making daily posts from the trial, then she married again, and he turned out to be gay. So at one point in the play, I say, if gay men treated me like they treated Anita Bryant, I would probably hate them too.
So she became a symbol for gay hate.
She became a symbol because they passed a equal employment ordinance in Broward-Dade County in southern Florida for gay men and lesbians. The T word had not entered yet. And that passed, and she started a crusade to unravel that, and she did. And her organization was named Save the Children, as if gay people ate children or worse. And so she put that together, and she became a national icon.
There were very few recorded instances of that.
Yeah.
Of gay people eating children.
We don't have much of that. At any rate, she became a national symbol for that movement, and then the Texas Bar Association at their convention in Houston 1977 invited her to come down and sing at one of the events during their convention. And so she came here, and the decision was made to be kind of an affront to the gay community. But I don't know if you remember Jane Ely, a big raw-bone lesbian columnist for the Houston Post at the time.
She was a good friend.
Oh, she was wonderful. She wrote Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and gave us about a month's lead time. Well, if you're an activist, a month is forever.
Yeah.
You can organize anything in a month. And so we put together a welcoming party. The police laughed when we said we were going to have 500 people because there had never been a 500-person demonstration in Houston history for any matter. We had 12,000.
Right, right.
And
I remember.
That changed the paradigm. Yeah. The term gay community over 24 hours changed from meaning the part of town where the bars are to a group of people with common goals and aspirations.
You know, people don't realize, and we're about to take a break here. I'm talking with Ray Hill. The significant role that Houston played in the gay liberation movement, the LGBT movement, whatever, it was called the gay movement at that time, certainly. What a seminal role Houston played in that, as well as in the women's movement. So there's a lot of history there that people don't know about. Okay, Ray Hill is my guest on Rag Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, it's time for all of us to imagine. Thank you, Tracy Schultz, for playing that.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Ray Hill is our guest. Ray Hill is was a pioneering gay activist in Houston, a prison rights activist who had a long-running prison show on KPFT, which he helped found, and has a remarkable history. I mean, I only read a very small, for our introduction, I just sort of skipped through what I had written there. So, Ray, we're back.
Yeah, well, let me finish milking this Anita Bryant
and
town meeting story. Well, that night, the words gay community changed from the part of town where the bars are, which is what the gay community meant in every city in the United States. But coming together, 12,000 of us who had never seen that many queers in one pile before, was so reinforcing that it changed not what we thought about Anita, but what we thought about ourselves. And on my way back to the parked cars from that demonstration, I realized that we had become a community of people, but we had no institutions to sustain that community. So as an activist, a good old Saul Alinsky-trained activist, a social worker mindset, I decided to call a democratic parliamentary procedure meeting of as many gay people as I could get together to decide what we were going to do with that community and establish some institutions that would support it. And that happened for our Pride Week activities in 1978. It was called Houston Town Meeting 1. And out of that grew Montrose Counseling Center, which is now Montrose Center, institution still in operation serving community, Montrose Clinic, which is now Legacy Health Services, which has 7 locations around the city and provides health care for not only GLBT people, but for other people who whose insurance or Medicaid, Medicare doesn't cover everything, will do it. And so we got some sustaining, but one of the groups that came out of that was the Houston Transgendered Political Movement. And the way it worked is I would ask all these people to make a resolution to create the institution they wanted treated, but the transgender people weren't interested in institutions, so they introduced a resolution that said Town Meeting 1 shall be opposed to workplace dress codes for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
As far as they were concerned. And so that was their resolution. It was the only resolution that was debated. We debated it for an hour and a half. The whole thing was chaired by me and Jenny Apuzzo out of New York. She used to write speeches for Mario Cuomo, who's best known for his oratory. That should tell you something. And Jenny and I chaired it, and we debated that resolution for an hour. It passed. It wasn't even close. It was 60-40 margins that passed. And then next day I got a call from transgender activists, now Judge Phyllis Fry, who said, I can't believe all those other resolutions passed and ours had to be done. I said, hon, the way this works, since it was the only one that was debated, it's the only one nobody will remember. Everybody will remember in the middle of next week, and sure enough. And that's kind of the cornerstone of what has become transgendered movement, which is alive and well.
Oh, absolutely.
And Caitlyn Jenner is just the latest manifestation of a phenomena that will ever be with us.
Okay, how important? I mean, certainly people like Rachel Maddow and Ellen DeGeneres were incredibly important in as public figures who were openly gay. Mm-hmm. How significant is Caitlyn Jenner? And I have to bite my tongue because I don't like all of that reality television stuff and that.
Well, I don't like reality television stuff either. In the first place, I think it's bad media, and I think it has some inherent flaws, and we're running across some of that with some of the Christian movement stars these days.
Yeah.
Who've got a whole laundry full of dirty laundry.
Yeah, but it's a whole pretense of it being reality, for one thing. But
sure.
In any event, and then her showing up, in this as this glamour figure right now. But on the other hand, it's just, I guess, incredibly important to have someone out there who is this going to be the moment as far as as a transgender
movement? Well, you know, it can go several different ways. It can blow up in your face. But the movement is here because the people do exist. They're real. And, you know, the words carved over the front portal of the Supreme Court of the United States is not the Fifth Amendment, the Eighth Amendment, or even the First Amendment. What they've got carved over the front door is equal justice under the law, and or equal justice under law. And that meaning, once you or your movement or your group of people progress to the point that you're considered people, you're entitled to the same rights and privileges that everybody else, and the same responsibilities that everybody else is doing. But there's this wonderful quote. Today is Bill Moyer's birthday. And a quote from Bill Moyer about what we're talking about. News is what people want to keep hidden. Everything else is publicity.
Right.
Isn't that poignant?
That's a great quote. And I mean,
yeah.
He's a treasure, of course.
Oh, yes, and he's an old Texan.
Yeah.
He's an ex-preacher, and he's been known to be a radio guy. I got a lot of things in common with this fellow.
Yeah. So a lot of that history started, or a lot of, at least the coming together, the forming and are recognizing a real community back early on. We're talking when?
Well, kind of what happened when Anita came to Houston is the spark that was lit.
When was that?
That was June the 14th. 1977.
That was 77, okay.
77, and that was the... I'd only been out of prison since 75, and so here I was, by default, leading the Houston gay and lesbian movement, and I say out of default because nobody else wanted to be out there. Nobody else had the courage. And then the next year we did Town Meeting 1, and that helped solidify us as a community, and once you do that, you can do a better job of organizing and advancing. And then in 1979, I was the national chair for the March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights, which was Harvey Milk's march, but he got assassinated before he could lead it.
Right. Okay, you referred to getting out of prison, when did you go to prison? You went to prison, I think I saw the term referenced as a gentleman burglar.
Well, I went to prison in November of 1970, sentenced to 160 years.
Okay.
Or 20 consecutive 8-year sentences. And what that meant is that if I'd made parole on one of the sentences, I'd just start another one. So I went to prison with the idea that I was going to be there for the rest of my life, and I got down there, and I was down there for 3 or 4 years, and I prospered there, Thorne. I realized that the first thing you worry about if you got to go to prison is how do I survive? Well, I had that figured out in about a week. And then the next thing is, well, if I'm going to survive, how do I prosper? And what does prosper mean here? And so I decided my job description was the same as the warden. I was there to keep this enormous plantation institution operating smoothly. And inasmuch as I facilitated that or helped that, I would be rewarded. And inasmuch as I hindered that, I would be punished, perhaps severely. So I became the maintenance bookkeeper, and that's the guy that keeps the lights on and the water running. I use inmate labor. I don't actually fix the plumbing or the electricity, but I've got inmates that do that and guards to escort them and keep the doors open. In prison, opening and closing of doors is like such a, you wouldn't believe how big of a deal that is. But I did all of that, and I did all that very well because gay people, they used to call us eunuchs, you know. We're pretty good at bureaucracy stuff. And so I kept the parts on hand that I would need to fix the heaters and the fans and the light glass planes and the windows. And I did what a good eunuch or bureaucrat would do, and I did that very well. And then one morning I got up and I said, I just didn't want to do this anymore. So I went to the law library and became a jailhouse lawyer, and within a year I was out.
Were you out because of your jailhouse lawyering?
Yes. I filed an Eighth Amendment writ saying it was cruel and unusual punishment to sentence somebody to a 160-year sentence for nonviolent crimes against property, because my crimes was I stole. I was a burglar, and I stole what queers know about, antiques, art, jewels, and electronics.
Uh-huh. And so did prison cure you of your burglarness?
Well,
you don't have to answer that.
I've had two productive careers. Most of my life I've lived below the poverty line. I'm living below the poverty line now. The only time I had any money is when I was either preaching as a teenage evangelist or stealing as a burglar. And they rewarded me for the former and punished me for the latter, and I always thought it should have been the other way around. I don't think much about doing burglaries anymore. I mean, in the first place, since I got a peg leg, I'd leave a funny footprint. It'd be easy to identify.
It'd be hard to run, too. Huh?
Yeah, right. You can't scamper away under those circumstances.
Right. Okay, so you got out. Tell me, and you were one of two people that I know at KPFT who had very, very large audiences among prison population, and the other one was Huey Moe, the crazy Cajun. How did you decide to start the prison radio show, and
well,
what was your concept?
Well, I didn't start the prison show. When I first got out of prison, I got out in March of 1975, went back to KPFT, of which I had been the going on the air, one of the co-founders. Now, by the time we got on the air, I was already in prison. Well, not quite. We got on the air in March of 70, and I went to prison in November of 70. Was in and out of jail a lot, so wasn't around a whole bunch on my way to prison.
I understand that one of the things that attracted you to KPFT in the early before it started was that you thought Larry Lee was cute.
Larry Lee was cute. There's no question about it.
Larry Lee, I should mention, was the prime mover behind
clearly. The guy who's KPFT, it was his inspiration. Right. Larry greeted me as I stepped off the set out at Channel 2 on the Ray Miller, The Last Word show, and invited me to join a coalition to build a radio station, which had not yet been even started. And so in the beginning, it was Don Gardner. Larry had a terrible crush on Don Gardner, but Larry couldn't come out of the closet for reasons of the era, and so Don didn't even know that until after Larry had gone elsewhere and grown old and died.
My friend Al Reinert was development director during that pre-existence phase.
My main thing is that I was a thief. I had a lot of money. And so I paid for all of the direct mail postage and things of that nature as an anonymous donor.
So how did the prison show come about?
Well, when I got out of prison, I came back to KPFT and started doing Wildenstein, which was the gay lesbian show.
Right. You said it was one of the first in the country of its kind, and the first certainly in the South.
And I did that for about 5 years, and then Judy escaped, and the staff kind of selected me to be manager, and then the lawyer said, no, you can't do this. And we said, why not? And they said, well, FCC law says people have to be of good moral character. And I said, well, what legally does that mean? And he said, well, we don't know either, but it certainly doesn't include perverts and convicts. And so we challenged the law. So you had two strikes.
Gay
ex-convict, manager of a licensed broadcast facility in the United States.
There are a lot of firsts at KPFT. Of course, the radio station was the first station in the country to be bombed off the air, to have its transmitter bombed. And, of course, that happened twice with the station. Continue.
And so when I became manager, I woke up one morning and I said, you know, I can do anything I want to as long as it is radio. And so I started doing the prison show, which I thought somebody needed to put a flashlight then down that dark alley, and it just caught on. But Thorne, I've been in radio since I was 7 years old.
Seven? I knew you had been in radio all your life.
No. I had a. Do you know what a Jennet is?
No.
Female jackass.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and I had a Jennet whenever I was 7 years old, and I rode her up to a shack in the middle of a big vacant lot, and there was a radio station in that shack, and I went in to talk to the guy. It was a single operator.
Was this like what they now call a pirate radio station?
No, it was sun up, sundown AM. It was a licensed station.
Okay.
It would come on at sun up and go off at sundown so that you left room at night for a clear channel. And radios, that wasn't a company, it was a concept at the time.
Right.
And so I went in there, and that guy wanted to smoke and drink, but he had all these vacuum tubes that were giving off gases. He couldn't smoke in there, and he couldn't drink in there. So he taught me how to cue up 78 RPM records. And at 7 years old, those suckers are heavy.
I remember them.
And cue them up and try to sound like a cowboy between Roy Acuff and Hank Williams and the like.
A seven-year-old cowboy.
Seven-year-old cowboy broadcasting on radio station KBUK, Baytown, Texas.
How about that? Oh, boy. A lot of history here. Believe it or not, and this is just speeding along, we're going to need to take another break.
Okay.
This has been another 20 minutes.
Times are burning up.
Oh, boy. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My guest is Houston living legend, Ray Hill.
Nobody can tell you, there's only one song worth singing. They may try and sell you, 'cause it hangs them up to see someone like you. But you've gotta make your own kind of music, sing your own special song. Make your own kind of music, even if nobody else sings along. You're gonna be nowhere, the loneliest kind of lonely. It may be rough going just to do your thing, the hardest thing to do. But you've gotta make your own kind of music, sing your own special song. Make your own kind of music, even if nobody else sings along. So
if Mama Cass.
Yeah, that was a good find. You were saying that is a theme song of sorts. It's like an anthem.
It's supposed to be a classic of the genre. Ray Hill is my guest on Rag Radio. That was Tracy Schultz you just heard. Ray was a pioneering gay rights activist, was a co-founder and longtime broadcaster at KPFT-FM, and has an incredible history. Ray, welcome back.
Well, glad to be back. I did the prison show. The prison show continues even without me. But I did it for 32 years.
Yeah,
and
that's...
I was both host and producer, so I did. It was all my show. And the only way I knew how to run that particular show, which I always considered experimental media, because I'd go on the air, Thorne, and I wasn't talking to these wonderful people that are listening to your show. I wasn't talking to everybody out there. I was talking to convicts.
Right.
And I had a lot to say to convicts, and I suckered them in with their mother's voice and their children and their wives, because the most important feature was the call-in time of the show. But while I had them for the hour before that, I talked to them about their contributions through their addictions and their behavior to the oppression that they were experiencing and what they could do for themselves to diminish that oppression. And I didn't come from a religious standpoint. I came from a secular point of view. I was very loudly and openly an atheist on the show. But I had in-house Baptists and Muslims and Catholics to kind of make sure that nobody felt that the prison show wasn't their personal thing. And I did that for 32 years. It was enormously successful in terms of generating and maintaining an audience. We always did our fair share of support for the radio station. And in non-commercial media, that's an important element, too. I thought it was, and I won all kinds of awards for doing it, and got an enormous amount of coverage in other media for doing it. The prison show will not die because one personality has retired from the scene. It will live or die because of the need of it, and we simply lock up too many people for too much time for too little reason, and we're going to have to do something about that because it now costs us a mean of $34,000 a year to keep people in prison. And we can't afford to do that. So reform is a-coming. And who is going to play a leadership role in that reform are not do-gooders and politicians. It's going to be the people that have been affected, the people who have been to prison, and the people who have loved ones in prison.
Right, and it's prison. The way we incarcerate people is kind of finally, and the massive prison complex, the prison industrial complex, is finally becoming an issue that people are addressing because it's costing so much in lives and money.
They're wonderful people in literature. Michelle Alexander's new Jim Crow is a wonderful thing. The Orange is the New Black. Approach the thing is to get people to think outside of the existing paradigm is important, and that's happening. And as we think, so will we go. I had, after 32 years on the prison show, I'm kind of a nationally recognized authority on prisons and things, and I'm working with the American Law Institute, which is kind of the Bar Association for law professors. And they're the people who will actually wind up changing the law. Because way back in the 70s, they wrote the Model Penal Code, which over a decade was every state in the United States.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. The prison show lasted a long time and was very significant, and it continues today.
Yeah.
I want to go to another area.
Okay.
Well, there are a couple of things. One, I want to talk about the. I know you got arrested in 2012 at a strip club where you claimed that Houston police.
Oh, that was just the most recent of a series.
I know you've been arrested a number of times over the years. But what I really want to know about is the lawsuits you were involved in, including the one that went to the Supreme Court.
Just as I was retiring out. As general manager of KPFT, I was living a few blocks from the station to the corner of Westheimer and Whitney Street, and I lived in what is now a pizza place. And I was out on my front porch on Valentine's Day night, 1982, and two cops grabbed a young black man at the intersection, dragged him over in my yard, and started beating him with their flashlights. So I decided that, I'm sorry about the background noise, the Republicans are trying to get in here and get me.
Yeah, you can't put it past them.
But at any rate, the cops, I was trying to stop the cops, and I'd been wanting to get arrested for interrupting a police officer for a while because I thought the ordinance was unconstitutional. So I said, wait a minute, this is my yard. I got some say that goes on here, and that young man, nobody deserves a ass-whipping by the side of the road. And they said, you want to get your ass in the house, you son of a bitch, or we'll arrest you. And then I called them a noun unbecoming of their relationship with their mothers. And I called them that, knowing full well that was police magic words, and that they would forget all about Charles Hill and arrest me. And that's exactly what happened. They dropped him, ignored him completely, and came arrested me, and off we went to jail. Well, in 1987, 5 years later, the United States Supreme Court said that they thought everybody knew about cops and their mamas and couldn't understand why I got arrested. I was exonerated and compensated very well for going to jail. My lawyer friends were paid a whole lot more money for representing my rights. And that's a landmark First Amendment opinion that is still on the books. It's used in Travis County courtrooms every day.
Okay, and you've been involved in that issue of police abuse a lot over the
time.
Well,
the only way I can get involved is to find some damn fool cop that's so ignorant that he's willing to arrest me. And I have been arrested.
And he doesn't know what he's getting into when he decides to make that decision.
The police chief gave me a T-shirt, "Do not arrest this person," in stencil. because that's how cops communicate with one another, is in stencil. And it's kind of a joke here, but literally I have sued them five times, and five times I put money in the bank as a result of their arrest. So it's hard for me to get arrested in Houston, Texas.
Okay, especially when you wear that T-shirt. Okay, one other thing I wanted to add. Ray, I don't think I've mentioned before, Ray Hill is the subject of three documentary films, and has also written and performed in several plays, some of which have won some awards. And I thought that there was kind of a fun story about the play Ray Hill and the Sex Police,
yeah.
and Edward Albee. Why don't you tell us that story?
Well, Edward Albee showed up for the audience, and since the Chronicle was there to review it, Edward Albee's a handy person to ask, "What did you think, Mr. Albee?" And he gave me a great quote in the Chronicle. But Edward and I are friends. I have a habit of befriending greatest living American playwrights. Little known fact is way back in the 60s, early 60s, I was the eye candy on Tennessee Williams' left elbow in New Orleans.
Uh-oh.
So I hung around. Well, I wasn't his sex partner. He had a beat-up old lover, and when he did something on the side, he wanted longshoreman types, which didn't match my persona at the time. But I was respectable enough to be seen in public with, plus the fact I drove a Studebaker so we could arrive in style. But Tennessee and Edward Albee, they're really basically the same character, only Edward Albee's a whole lot more sober than Tennessee ever was. But the Ray Hill and the Sex Police was 40 years of stories of me driving vice cops out of gay clubs and adult video stores and just fighting vice cops in general. And, of course, since I'm telling a story, I'm the hero of every story. If you're telling the story, you got the right to do that. But it's funnier than Keystone Cops because they made every damn fool professional mistake you can make, and I was right there to take advantage of it.
Right. Okay. Well, Albee told you that there were too many sex toys in the play, away from the message. Is this right?
The last scene of that show is I talked about Texas obscene device law, which is about dildos, and so I always performed. At that time, there was a law in the books of Texas that if you're found in possession of six or more sexual devices, namely dildos and artificial vaginas and things, that you could be presumed under that law to be a wholesale distributor, and you could get felony and go to prison for that. Well, that's as unconstitutional as the day is long. And so I always made sure that I performed with at least a dozen on the stage. And I always sent an invitation to vice officers and prosecutors to come to the show and they could get in free if it was their intention to arrest me for having those dildos. Now, that's, you know, Jean Genet became a famous man because they arrested and charged him for his obscene writing, and Madame Bovary, they arrested the author of that. And that's how they sold a lot of books. Those folks got rich off of police action.
Right.
And so I thought, you know, this could work for me if I play it right. They all came to see the play, and they all enjoyed the play, and nobody arrested me. I was very disappointed.
Okay. Dildos or no?
Well, Everett okay. Albee told me yeah. at Disco Kroger, the day after the performance, I said, well, what did you really think about the play? I appreciate what you told the Chronicle, but what did you really think? And he said he thought that the image of all those dildos was so overpowering that he forgot some of the earlier very good lines that I used in the show. Well, when a guy with three Pulitzer Prizes on his mantelpiece tells you something like that, you take that for granted. Well, about a year later, he had a new play opening at the Alley called The Play About the Baby. And I go to, and I got a good seat in the front row. I'm going to see this this premiere performance. And there's no curtain in the Black Box Theater. But from behind the wall come running this stark naked guy with a three-quarter erection on, flopping right in our faces across the stage, and he's chased by a woman who's clutching a short towel between her breasts and running. And I said, that SOB, he thought my dildos were too powerful, and he's got the real thing in the opening scene of his new play. How the hell am I going to remember a line that's said after this?
Well, what can I say?
Well, I got even.
You got even, huh?
The morning after the premiere of The Play About the Baby, I went to One's a Meal over on West Gray, and there was Boy, the guy that played in the play the night before. And he was with a group of friends having breakfast, and I walked by and I said, I want to compliment you. You got a real nice naked. And he said, oh, you saw the play? I said, how the hell else would I know that? And we laughed and jabbed. And when his friends left, he joined me, and we had the rest of my breakfast together. So when I next saw Everett Albee, I said, you know, after premiere night, I was having breakfast with Boy. And Everett Albee's old school. He thinks if you have breakfast with them, you've spent the night with them. And I never corrected.
I didn't know that was old
impression.
School. I didn't know that was old school.
That's
but
old school.
I see.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, we've got 1 minute. What do you want to leave us with?
Well, gosh, we have eaten up this time.
I know.
I want to leave this with appreciation for your utilizing the medium. Us radio guys, people who love radio as a medium, have got to stop this vicious rumor that our medium is unusable, dead, it's old technology, it has no future. It has the brightest of future. Radio has the depth and the character that you can't get in visual media. Because I have engaged, and you have engaged, the imagination of the listeners in this show. They are participants in this show. Every one of them heard something slightly different because of their memories and their imaginations and their experiences.
Okay, and you helped give them some material to use their imagination on, too.
That's right,
I
know how to do
all
that.
Right. Okay, thank you. Ray Hill, it's been a pleasure. We'll do it again. We'll start
Please.
Where we left off.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much. Next week on Rag Radio, cultural historian Richard Pels, author of War Babies, The Generation That Changed America. And the next Friday, Maria Svart, National Director of the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA. So we got a lot of stuff coming. Thank you, Tracy Schultz. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio.